City of Death, City of Friends. Can you elaborate on
that? Well, I expect to die here. And I have friends here.
Pretty simple.
Yeah.
It has a much different ring when, you know, when someone reads it, I guess. I don't know. Could have.
Yeah.
Could you see the Vancouver book continuing?
Bowering wanted me to continue it. It may, because right now I'm finishing up a book which will probably be called After Desire, and the first section of it is After Desire. It's in the CAP review, and then there are three more sections of it. And this last section I'm working on, it may develop into something like that, but I'm not sure. Certainly not the same stance, the same method, but maybe something similar. Like I said, in the interview in the CAP review, I said, well, I was really through with that way of writing, but I don't think I am through with that way of writing.
You were a year and a half or whatever ago.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, but it's come back in a sense.
Yeah.
You know, to write projectively takes a lot of energy. Robert Creeley, who was a projectivist, you know, right up there with Olson, minimus to Olson's maximus, he stopped writing projectively near the end of his life, started writing really formal poems.
Yeah.
You think that's because he ran out of energy, or what do you think?
Well, you can get it whatever works for you. I believe in Spicer's principle of dictation, but I think it's widely misunderstood. Spicer had no objection to revision at all.
Right, so it's a little different than Allen's first thought, best thought. A little different than that.
Yes.
Although Allen also said that it's not first thought chronologically. You might be stirring
right.
It. Right. So could you elaborate on why people misinterpret the notion of dictation?
Oh, yeah, because they assume that it's something... Because Spicer at one point mentions Yeats was interested in...
Spooks,
and I think that his wife, Georgie, was doing dictation, writing down things that she had that were transmitted to her from somewhere else. And also the other reference that Spicer makes is to Cocteau's film The Testament of Orpheus, where the character played by Jean Marais, that's Orpheus, is listening to the voice of Segeste on the car radio. And the radio is a big image in Spicer's book. But all of this have led some people to think that it is strictly dictation, that you write, that the poem is coming from somewhere else and you write it down. Now, Persky told me that this was largely true of Spicer, particularly towards the end, that he didn't do any revision. But Spicer and I had conversations about this, and he said, well, look, there's nothing wrong with revision as long as you're listening for the poem. I mean, if you've got a lot of your own crap in this draft here, then you revise it to get that crap out. But your aim must always to be to get the to channel the poem.
The way I try to explain it to people is like a continuum, you know, where a 14 line sonnet in iambic pentameter with a rhyming couplet that you know what it's going to be. Writing a poem that way is perhaps as far to the right as you can get, whereas the poem that just comes out perfectly dictated from some entity from Mars or wherever is the other pole, but the real poem is somewhere in the middle, and for you probably a lot closer to the left than the right.
Well, I don't think the writing the sonnet that even exists as a possibility any longer. I think the people who have attempted to do that, like the school, what is this called?
I know what you're going to say. The new formaldehyde.
The new formaldehyde. Yes. The last poet who could do that, I think, was Yeats. You had to be schooled in meter and rhyme from age 5 to be able to write poetry like Shelley did, or Byron, or Yeats.
But the big question, why?
The intermediate case is T.S. Eliot, who talks about the struggle, the unendurable struggle between with words and meanings. And I read a little essay letter in the London Review of Books, and raises a very interesting question. Do you think John Ashbery engages in a struggle with words and meanings? And I thought, no, not at all. John Ashbery is past that point. Eliot is still trying to write the poem as the way it's supposed to be. Asperger's beyond that point. I'm still at the Elliott level, I think. I'm still trying to do it the way it's supposed to be.
When I use
this method of the Linda Barry Peter Elbow method, I surprise myself. I come up with stuff that I never would have imagined. The poem just carries me along. Right.
Elliott would have never gone for that.
No. No. I don't know. Early Elliott is the most, probably the deepest influence on me is early Elliott and then a bit of Auden.
I'm reminded of a line by George Bowring ending one of his poems in My Darling Nellie Gray, written in bird shit. Courbacy, Elliott, no.
Well, Bowring is an incredible genius. The fact that he would write that book, one poem a day, that's not that surprising. But the fact that the first month, the January section of it, is a great poem. You know, writing one poem a day, anybody maybe, but writing a great poem, one poem a day,
for a whole fucking year.
Yeah, right. Some of the months are not as great as others, but that first that January section is anyway. Yeah, he's a great genius.
Yeah, pretty remarkable.
Yeah.
I want to go back to your time in northern B.C. in a place called Terrace.
It's
an event that you say really changed you. Can you speak to how?
Well, it saved my life in a way. The way I put it is that I had to be a man there. Whereas if I were living in Vancouver or San Francisco or New York, I wouldn't have to take on that aspect of manhood. I could just be ever-aging adolescent, half-drunk poet. There are lots of people like that in New York and London and San Francisco.
And a lot of who aspire to that.
Yeah, who aspire. Yeah, it even becomes a point of aspiration, particularly in Dublin.
Right. So I'm picturing you wearing a flannel shirt, chopping wood and what, chopping down trees, or no?
No, it's not that. It's that I had a job teaching English at a community college. I was a figure of respect, of authority in a small community. Everyone knew who I was, and everyone knew that what I was doing was important, and raising the level of the town, because the town didn't have a community college before that; only had a vocational school. So I was able to become a man, as I say, and live my life the way a man ought to, as a respected member of the community. And it's the most important thing I ever did in my life, was to participate in the education of that generation of university-bound students in Terrace and other towns in northwest British Columbia.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me that you had an opportunity to be that authority figure that you needed in your youth. You know, I'm looking at your family saying, no, you can't. You're becoming a left-wing commie pinko.
Yeah,
you have
right.
to cut off your funding. Yes. Then you go in the army, and it's the kind of discipline that teaches you better how to not feel so that you can kill other people.
Yes.
And here's your opportunity to be an authority figure who's going to really give people the straight, here's how to be a human, right?
Not quite, no. The first authority figures I ran into were Spicer and Duncan. Maybe a couple of my high school teachers as well. No, what I mean is I had to be a man in the sense that that community, in that community's sense of being a man. An upstanding citizen. And also, of course, what I discovered when I got to Terrace was that I was in Canada, which I never knew, living for the first five years I lived in Vancouver. It was just another West Coast town like Seattle or San Francisco. Terrace is Canada. Terrace is Ontario. It's an Ontario town.
Because it was founded by people from Ontario.
Yeah, right.
You know. So when you say it was Canada as opposed to Vancouver, how do you make that distinction?
Well, it was, first of all, it was a small town. It related to Ontario. It was basically a Protestant town, mostly fundamentalists. But as is so common in Canadian resource towns, you have half the town is right-wing fundamentalist, and the other half are trade unionists, many near communism. So that's, I discovered that too. No, I hadn't known any of that in Vancouver. It was just the discovery, in a way, of Canada. And then I've told this story many times. It was probably in the Cap Review book. But I knew, as an instructor in English, I would have to teach a course the following year in Canadian literature. I began reading Canadian literature, and I found out that Canadian literature is about small towns. And so here I'm learning about the place I'm living, and also learning the text I will have to teach in that place. So a real connection there that I made with Canada. I didn't learn until much, much later that I could not become a Canadian poet.
Why is that?
Well, in 1971, I applied for a Canada Council grant. Now, that's surprising. I just got to town. But during that time, the Trudeau era, the federal government was handing out lots of money. And so I applied, and I was turned down. I got two of the judges voted against me and one for me. And the one who voted for me told me what one of the other judges had said. And that man said, it's okay to be an American, and it's okay to be from BC, but not both. And so I couldn't be a Canadian because A, I'm American, B, I identify as gay, C, I'm from British Columbia, which is suspect even for Canadians.
Right. So strike three.
Strike three, yes.
Yeah. Being gay and terrorist, did that cause any problems?
No, it didn't. I mean, did it cause me personal problems? Maybe a bit of some personal problems, but I don't recall actually coming out. We were at a period, let's see, this is 76 to 90. I think that most of my close friends knew that I was gay, and occasionally the subject would come up. Oh, of course it did. It came up when I ran for school board. Yes, and the local newspaper published an editorial against me saying the terrorist does not want his homosexual school trustee. But in general, not. In general, and maybe this is something very Canadian, as long as you don't embarrass anybody, people will accept you for whatever you are. So it was not a problem to me.
So except
plus the fact that I was an English instructor, and there were other gay people on the both men and women on the faculty, so right. I wasn't alone.
So accepted, but not accepted as a Canadian, and you say never will be.
Never will be, right? As a Canadian poet, as a Canadian citizen, yes, I'm a passionate Canadian citizen. I'm on the. Up till very recently on the executive committee of the local New Democratic Party, the Federal Writing Association. So I'm very much involved in federal Canadian politics.
Yeah. Does it help fuel some of the poetry? I mean, you know, poets are always outcasts. They always feel that they don't fit in. They use that kind of that friction of not fitting in for their work. So you should be set up for a good long while to.
Well, no, but I still feel part of the American poetry scene. So I have connections in San Francisco, Milwaukee, New York, Boston.
Certainly a West Coast poet.
Well, that's what I am, a West Coast boy all the way.
Yeah, and which is more interesting to me. I mean, I live here, so maybe I'm privy to it. But, you know, what is it? I've been interested in this concept called Cascadia. You know, if I had my magic wand, it'd be a country, you know, today at midnight. But and maybe there's hope because the Soviet Union balkanized pretty quickly. So maybe there's hope, especially with the spending priorities of the Obama administration and the Harper, which is even more right wing than that.
Yes.
So there's hope for that, I think. But and the way we've used mapped by David McCloskey, which starts Cascadia at about Cape Mendocino.
Mm-hmm.
So it leaves out San Francisco. Obviously, San Francisco, a huge influence on Vancouver and West Coast poetry in general. But what do you think it is about? What sets the poetry of this region apart?
Well, start with the history. You can say that there is a arm of Anglo-American civilization that is on the West Coast from San Francisco north. And it arrived by basically three routes. It arrived around the Horn to San Francisco, New York to San Francisco. It arrived across the prairies and up through the mountains to Portland, the Oregon Trail, and it arrived from Montreal to British Columbia. Those are the three sources. And it is, I think of it as being one kind of a branch of civilization in a way, a small one. I forgot the other question.
What are the salient and interesting qualities of the best verse from here?
Well, now we go back again to the fact that I'm totally ignorant of anything that's going on in Oregon and Washington. Well, the openness, which comes largely from Olson and Duncan, so it's American sourced. A kind of humanity, tolerance, maybe a sense of the world. I'm not sure I can name the particular poets, but certainly for Canadians, the world exists in a way that it doesn't exist for Americans, or for any other power that considers itself a world power. But Canadians know they're not a world power, so therefore they have an idea of the world, of the planet.
Which includes a good dose of healthy humility.
Yes, I think so, yeah. The soft-spokenness of Canadians, right? Well, I was just walking around downtown yesterday on Canada Day, just among the crowds, and it's not a boisterous crowd.
Unless they lose the Stanley Cup.
Oh, yeah. Well, right, yes. They're nice people. Canadians are nice people.